Searching for stars on an island in Maine. Ruminations about the big questions in science, philosophy, and religion. For decades, theoretical physicist and author Alan Lightman has been spending summers on a small island in Casco Bay. There, he allows himself to stop and think, really think, about the natural world around him, his place in the universe, the connections between scientific theory and religion, the nature of the universe, and more. Lightman, who is perhaps best known for his book, Einstein's Dreams, has now gathered some of those thoughts and created a new book of essays, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Professor Lightman joins us in the studio to talk about his special corner of Maine, religion, science, and more. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Theoretical physicists are not often well known to the public, but when they also write best-selling novels, they are a little more accessible to us regular folks. And that is the case with our guest today. With me in the studio, Alan Lightman. He worked for many years as a theoretical physicist, and he is also the author of six novels, including the international bestseller Einstein's Dreams. He has also written a memoir, three essay collections, and several books on science. Alan has taught at Harvard and MIT and is known for his work bridging science and the humanities. He lives in the Boston area and has a summer home on a very small island in Maine. His new book, which just came out, is a collection of essays called Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you read any of Alan Lightman's works? Are you interested in the intersection or the lack of intersection of science and religion and why it matters? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Alan Lightman, thank you so much for being here. Tell us about the island that you call Loot Island.
My wife is a painter, and we wanted a summer retreat where she could paint and I could write. And it was around the late 80s. We heard from friends of friends that there was an island available in Maine. Of course, there were a few lots on the island. We aren't the only people there. And at that time, there was no electricity to the island. There was no fresh water. And so we took a chance. And we already love the state of Maine. And it's really our spiritual center. Our children have grown up spending their summers there, and it's been really the bright spot in our lives. It's where we slow down and unplug from the rest of the world.
I love that you called it your spiritual center, because after reading your book, this is sort of the center of what you're grappling with, is the whole idea of whether there is even such a thing as a spirit.
Yeah. Well, We live a very privileged life there, and we recognize that we're privileged to be able to take off the summer. Of course, we're both working, doing our creative work, but not many people can go off to a place like that for 3 months in the summer. And it's a place where we slow down, because the world is moving much too fast for its own good. Everybody's plugged into the grid 24/7. And we don't really have time to hear ourselves think, to think what's important to us, what our values are, what we want to do with our lives. And you really have to unplug to have those kinds of thoughts. And the island on Maine in the summer is when we unplug.
You say you spend a lot of time sitting.
I spend time sitting, lying, of course, a lot of time walking, but I like to sit on big chunks of moss. We have a hammock on our front veranda, and I like to lie in the hammock. And it's blissful. It's idyllic.
At the beginning of this book of essays, you talk about a transformative moment for you that happened right off the shore of the island. Will
yes.
you share that?
Well, it's a small island, and there are no roads or bridges to the island. So there's six houses, six families live on the island, and we all have our own boats. And one night in the wee hours of the morning, after midnight, I was coming home alone in the boat to the island, and it was dark. The stars were just vibrating in the sky. And I took a chance and turned off the running lights, and it got even darker. And then I took another chance and turned off the engine, and it got extremely dark. And it was very, very quiet with the engine off. And I just lay down in the bottom of the boat on my back and looked up at the sky. And I felt like I was falling into infinity. I lost all track of time. I lost track of my body. And I felt connected to something much bigger than myself. That's what I call a spiritual experience, or a transcendent experience. And I know many people have had similar experiences. But I felt, looking up at the stars, I felt like all of time from the distant past, long before I was born, to the distant future, long after I will be dead, was compressed to a dot.
Mm.
It was just an amazing experience. And, of course, I've been a physicist for many years, and I've always had a very rational, materialist view of the world, a reductionist view where every experience, everything in the world is reducible to atoms and molecules, and everything is material. But this was a non-material experience, feeling connected to something really large.
I was going to say, you know, a lot of people, maybe not a lot, but other people also have an experience, whether it's with the stars or with the sea, but not many of them are theoretical physicists. So for you, this starts you down a rabbit hole that really doesn't end.
Well, it was a juxtaposition or a confrontation between my scientific side and my spiritual side, or between my materialist side and my ethereal side, if you want to put it that way. So I actually think of myself now as a spiritual materialist, which sounds like a contradiction of terms, but I think that it sort of represents the complex duality of human beings, that we're builders and we're dreamers, and we're experimenters and we're experiencers. We have a scientific side and we have a spiritual side, and all of that is part of the complicated nature of what makes us human. And I think that we go astray when we cut off one piece of that, when we decide that we're just going to take a purely reductionist view of the world, a purely rational view. And we also take a wrong step if we decide that we're only going to look at the qualitative, the anecdotal, the immaterial. You know, science has brought a lot of good things to us. It's brought us smartphones and antibiotics, but it's not all there is. It doesn't embrace all of human experience.
How has your book been received by other scientists you know?
Mixed. Some of my colleagues are put off by discussions of things that are not reducible to equations, and the sort of the personal tone of the book Others are okay with it. They understand it.
They grapple with the same questions,
I'm sure. Especially in theoretical physics has always been the most philosophical of all of the sciences. It's where science confronts theology and philosophy and theoretical physics. You know, what happened before the Big Bang and questions, what's time and space? So it is a good place to be for the juxtaposition of these various issues.
So I was going to ask you this question later in the interview, but you brought it up. I'm going to ask you, what happened before the Big Bang?
Well, of course, we don't know. That's the first answer, and we will never know. But there are scientific theories and bona fide card-carrying physicists who have ideas about that. And the leading idea is that the Big Bang was the creation of our universe, but there are a lot of other universes which are constantly coming into being, sort of materializing out of an amorphous foam of space and time. And the different universes that come into being, some of them have the properties to keep expanding and make stars and carbon and oxygen and produce life, but many of them are just formless energy with no life on them. So that's sort of the current thinking, that our universe is just one of many, and that there was a space and time before the beginning of our universe. So there was no beginning of time in that view. There's just the beginning of our universe.
And I ask you that question not out of the blue, but because it's one of the many questions that you explore in your book. Professor, I'd like you to read a passage from your book, if you don't mind. I understand this is something any of us over the age of 50 will relate to.
All right. And for those in our 60s, we might have happened twice. For me, the human body is the most amazing and baffling phenomenon of the material world. How could it be that the exquisite and indescribable experience of consciousness, of thought and emotion, of the overpowering sense of an I, is simply the result of so many electrical and chemical flows between neurons, which are themselves nothing but atoms and molecules? I'm constantly struck, dumb, by this mystery. Some years ago, I had a colonoscopy without being fully anesthetized and was able to watch on a computer screen the shifting views of the insides of my colon. I was dismayed. There, revealed in digital detail, was the deep interior of my body, a realm I had always considered as mysterious, a forbidden temple, fragile and secretive as it went about its profound business of keeping me alive. Surely that mystical place was separate from the world of tables and chairs and gratefully hidden from the direct gaze of my eyes and my mind. But here it was, with no illusions. I was shocked to see ordinary flesh. I was shocked to see gelatinous membranes like quivering jelly, whitish in color, with bumps and ridges and turns. I felt like a trespasser in my own body. My colon was just material stuff. I am just material stuff, or so I believe. I know this intellectually, yet I recoil from the idea.
That's a great passage. And on the next page, you go on to talk about sort of a There's so many ways you can divide science, but in this case, the mechanist versus the vitalist. Explain to me that difference. And it was fun for me to read that because it put into words something, you know, debates I've had with friends and my husband, and I'm sure others as well have had the same experience when they read your book.
Yes, well, the debate is over the question of whether the human body is just a lot of material, or whether there's something, an addition, some magical, ethereal substance thing that makes life. And that debate has been raging for a couple of thousand years. And the two sides of the debate are called the mechanists and the vitalists. The mechanists feel that the body is just material. It's just a lot of microscopic levers and pulleys and chemicals and electricity flowing, and that's it. And the vitalists feel that there's something more, something intangible, something special, or maybe even sacred, that's the difference between a piece of inanimate matter and a piece of matter that has life. So that's the debate, and I think that science has basically come down in favor of the mechanists. The mechanistic view that we're all just, that everything in us is atoms and molecules and there's nothing more.
And if we haven't explained it yet, we will someday, right?
Right. Well, of course, there are a lot of things that we still don't understand and how the brain works. We believe that it's all material. But that explanation somehow is not completely satisfying. We don't want to believe that we're just atoms and molecules and nothing more.
After doing this thinking and writing these essays, have you changed in which camp you're in?
Well, I think that I'm still a materialist, but I do think that there are things out in the universe that are much bigger than us, that we are connected to somehow. So I think it's possible to have both views. The brain is an incredibly complicated organ, and there's a huge amount of thinking that goes on that we're not aware of, that we're not conscious of. And to me, there's a lot of room there for surprises. So I don't think that that's at odds with the materialist understanding of the brain. It's just that the brain is a vastly complicated thing. And the part of the brain that we associate with I-ness, with ego, of consciousness, of self, is only a tiny fraction of what's there in that 3 pounds of neurons and their connections. Only a tiny fraction. There's a huge amount of electrical and chemical activity and even decision-making going on there that we're not conscious of.
All right, everybody. You get to take a breath and ponder for just a minute what you've just heard. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Penobscot Financial Advisors, helping to shape the next era in workplace wellness with input from Mainers like you. Learn more at financially.fit. And Ocean View at Falmouth, proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow beginning at 12:30 p.m. on Maine Public Classical.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, a trans woman has her face surgically reconstructed so that people see her the way she sees herself.
My motivations aren't cosmetic. One of the ways that the world chiefly interacts with you is by your face, right? Is by looking at you.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour. That's tomorrow afternoon at 2, and again Sunday evening at 11, here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next On Being, physicist Carlo Rovelli on how all of reality is interaction.
So we are very complicated things, and we are like living on the top of this huge wave of happenings, which is ourself.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
And you can hear On Being Sunday morning at 6 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking with Alan Lightman about his new book and about its themes of science, religion, truth, and consciousness. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to calls, so I want to continue on the conversation we started before the break, talking about what it means to be human, what the I is. And in your book, Alan, you talk about the I as an illusion.
Yes. Well, I call it an illusion because it's a construction that if some giant cosmic being were looking at a human being, they would see just a lot of chemicals flowing and electrical currents flowing along neurons. They wouldn't see anything that they could call an eye. So we have these 100 billion neurons in our 3 pounds of brain, and each one is connected to 1,000 to 10,000 other neurons. And we understand pretty much the chemical and electrical activity of those neurons. There's still a lot that we don't know. But that's all there is, according to the scientific view. There's no driver in the cockpit. There's no center. There's no special group of neurons that is the driver. And there's nothing unphysical there. It's all material. It's all just chemicals and electricity. And yet, that collection of 100 billion neurons somehow produces a sensation that we label as consciousness and the I and the ego. But it's a sensation. It's a name that we're giving to a sensation. And that's the sense in which I mean it's an illusion. If you don't like the word illusion, you can just stick with the sensation itself. The sensation that we call consciousness, ego, self, I, that is a sensation, is a result of the purely material neurons, which are made of purely material atoms. And according to science, that's all there is. That's the end of it.
But even as you say that, you've got a big grin on your face, as though part of you doesn't quite believe it.
Well, of course, what I've just said is the scientific view, and it makes perfectly sense, and it's also perfectly absurd.
Right. I'm flipping through your book right now. There's a little tiny section I want to read to you and then talk about, if I can get there quickly enough. This is from page 70. Over the years that I've been summering at Lute Island, I've come to realize that my main occupation here has not been reading or writing, but figuring out whether it all adds up to anything. I will admit that the incoming stimuli are not forming patterns to my personal satisfaction. I love that. That's scientist language. The incoming stimuli are not forming patterns to my personal satisfaction. Your way of saying, I'm trying to make sense of it all, but it's not working.
It's not adding up.
It's not adding up. Oh, yeah. My goodness. We're going to go to Mike, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, it pleased me to hear you use the word absurd. I love that. I've been a questioner all my life. I started out, like a lot of folks around here, in traditional Protestant church, and couldn't accept that as I started to achieve the age of reason and questioning and such. And it still just gives me such humility. The more I search and learn, I've been on a long path of looking at this and looking at that. And basically my path has been everybody that told me they knew something, I'd sharpshoot it. Mm-hmm. I don't trust people that think they know it all. Mm-hmm. And by a process of winnowing, I understand either why. And especially when you think about what physics has taught us with the observer effect and the mysteries of entanglement of particles and such. And my God, but it's fascinating. It really is. And as far as the spiritual side of things, we sang a hymn in church recently that was entitled "Everything Is Holy Now," and that's kind of the way I feel about it now. Mm-hmm. You know, the more I am in awe of what I understand and what I don't even know I don't understand, there's something in it that. You know, it's worth the search, I guess. And I'm just really happy. I'm going to have to get your book and check it out. I wasn't aware of you before.
Mike, thank you so much for your call. Even the smartest scientist doesn't know what he or she doesn't know, right?
That's right. Well, I love your comment, Mike, that everything is holy now. That's such a beautiful way to be in the world. That also resonates a lot with a Buddhist view of just being present and just being open to everything that happens every minute and not just checking off items on your to-do list.
We'll move on to Felix calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead.
Hi. Couple of questions. Just for your opinion, no judgment on my behalf. What do you think of assisted suicide, and secondly, abortions?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to sidestep those questions. I know that they're very interesting, but that they're important issues, and I think that they polarize the country, and they're very intelligent people on both sides of those issues. So I don't really feel qualified, more qualified than you or other people to comment on that. So I'm going to let that go. I say that respectfully, Felix. Thank you for the questions.
Yeah, you know, this is, and his question, I think, is kind of related to part of what you're exploring in your book when you're looking at what is a human. What is life? You talk about the controversy when Dolly was first cloned, and then start thinking about, is wearing eyeglasses, is, you know, fixing cataracts, are we messing with nature?
Yeah.
Felix, thanks so much for your call. We'll move on to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Back a million years ago, I was surgery tech in the Air Force, and so I watched a lot of other people's internals. However, my point was when I had my heart ablation, I watched the monitor as he vectored the probe to various sections in my heart, and it was a whole lot of fun. It was a whole lot of fun up until the point he zapped me. And then he zapped me again, and by that time he realized I was semi-awake, and he told the anesthetist to put him down.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was interesting that you were able to see it. They won't let me, like when I had my insides looked at, they wouldn't let me watch. They says, you know too much.
Yeah. Well, if you could go back and redo it, would you prefer having seen your heart on the screen and had the pain of the zap, or would you rather have been anesthetized from the beginning?
I very, very much enjoyed watching him vector the probe. You know, they do it by magnetic pulses and whatnot. So I watched him vector the probe around inside my heart, which was a whole lot of fun. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just about how he was getting it. I'm a mathematician and physicist by training as well. And I had a whole lot of fun watching that. Mm-hmm. But when he zapped me, I thought, oh, are you sure you're getting the right spot? And then when he got the next one, it was even harder. And so at that point, when he said put him down, I said, I guess I'd rather be down.
Larry, thanks so much for your call. Alan, at the beginning of the program, we were talking about the moment in which you turned off the lights in the engine of your boat and sort of became one with the stars. And And that's looking at the universe and looking at cosmos. But also in your book, you're talking a lot about the infinity of the small. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes. Well, I think that if you look at the progression of science, we've gone in both directions. We've looked at things that are much larger than us, you know, planets and stars and galaxies, and we also have tried to break down matter into smaller and smaller units, much smaller than us, and around 1900, we thought that the atom was the smallest thing there was, and that that was the smallest building block, and everything was made out of atoms. And then around 1900, we found that there were subatomic particles. There were things that were smaller than atoms. And then we found the nucleus of the atom. In the 1980s and 90s, we began hypothesizing that even the neutrons and protons and electrons of atoms were made out of smaller things, possibly called strings. And it seems that we keep going to smaller and smaller elements of reality, so that there is an infinity going in the direction of the small, as well as an infinity going in the direction of the large. One curious and interesting thing that happens as you keep going down to smaller and smaller and smaller sizes, as you finally reach a size which is if you took one and you divided by one with 33 zeros after it of an inch, 33 zeros after the one, all in the denominator. And at that scale, at that size, we believe that even space and time loses its meaning. That at that scale, because of the effects of gravity and relativity theory, that and quantum physics, that time is jumping forwards and backwards, forwards and backwards. There's no clear direction of time. And space is kind of oscillating. There's no definite space. And at that point, even the words that we use, the language we use to describe what we're talking about, space and time, seems to lose meaning. So if you're asking what is the smallest object there is, and you get to smaller and smaller and smaller sizes, eventually you reach a point where even the space that contains the object doesn't have meaning.
So if that, at that level, space and time don't have meaning, and maybe the word, and I'm not sure if this is right, is chaos, how is it that if these are the building blocks of life, that meaninglessness doesn't continue build into a more meaningless universe?
That's a great question. And the answer to that is that once you get 1,000 or 10,000 of these smallest sizes together, the chaos starts averaging out. And it's just like if you look at a beach with sand on it, if you look very, very closely, there's sort of a random placement of the grains of sand. But if you get up 100 feet above the beach, it looks very smooth. So when you have enough of the chaotic things, the chaos gets averaged out and disappears.
So time as we know it is not smooth, but rather an average of...
Time as we know it is an average of a very chaotic granular structure.
We're going to go to Will, calling from Cornish. Hi, Will. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you. Doctor, I'm curious if you've read Heidegger's Being and Time and what you think of his description of us as being in his first 100 pages, where he essentially establishes his premise of what we are, and it's common to all of us. And I'd just like to add a quick add on to what you were just talking about. I'm curious as to what you think of, they call it the God particle, that's the moniker that got put on it, but that it came out at a 1.24, which was neither chaos nor supersymmetry. And I'll take answer off the...
Thanks, Will.
Well, I do know about Heidegger's book, Being in Time, and I would just point out that Heidegger is a philosopher and not a physicist. And his views, although very rich and provocative philosophically, would not be shared by physicists. Let's see, the second question you asked me was about the God particle. That's an unfortunate moniker. That name was given to a particular particle, which the physicists call it the Higgs boson, which is one of the subatomic particles, which interacts with other particles in such a way as to give them mass. So it's like the molasses in a jar that slows down anything you drop in the jar and makes it go slower, like a marble. The other particles get caught in the molasses of the Higgs particle, and it slows them down, and they get mass from that. But the name God particle is unfortunate because it suggests that there's something very, very special about that particular particle, and that it is non-material and somehow divine or something like that, and that's not the case.
We do have to take a quick break. We're talking with Alan Lightman, his most recent book, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. Before we take that break, though, a word about Monday's program. Join host Cindy Hahn for a conversation about independent bookstores in Maine and how they are thriving in the face of Amazon and other competition. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Ocean View at Falmouth, minutes from Portland and dedicated to offering active retirement living with peace of mind for the future. OceanViewRC.com.
A woman seeking asylum showed up for an official interview, but records marked her as a no-show.
That immediately allows her to be put in deportation proceeding, and she could be taken into custody.
She's now suing the federal government. On Next, we'll have that story, and we'll prepare for the 122nd running of the Boston Marathon.
What happened on April 15, 2013 is part of the story of that history.
Please join us.
Next is coming up next in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
How important are bees?
Bees are vital to the pollination and production of our fruits and vegetables. Squash, melons, pumpkins, cucumbers.
There's just one problem.
Unfortunately, they're all in trouble.
Everything is connected, from bees to toads to wolves to you. That's on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for the TED Radio Hour tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. And again on Wednesday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, author and physicist Alan Lightman. We're talking about science, the humanities, philosophy, nature, and astronomy, all of this explored in his new book, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Jeff calling from South Bristol. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
You know, I wanted to first comment on Mr. Lightman's Einstein's Dreams. That was a book that just completely opened my eyes to a new way of looking at everyday life, just as I was walking around and seeing things. It was totally amazing, and I've recommended it to many, many friends. But I wanted to comment about kind of this, and you've addressed it a little bit. I mean, I've never read Heidegger, but I have watched some of Neil deGrasse Tyson's Cosmos, and you know, I watched like three shows of that, and it was so unbelievably depressing. You know, you mentioned earlier this idea of multiple universes, and it just makes you feel like, you know, what's the point? I mean, how do you wrestle with that? I mean, you have an understanding of you know, something that's just way beyond the you know, the scope of human experience in some ways. And how do you cope with the idea that, you know, like you're going to be here and then you're not?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. What's the point? And before the 16th century, we thought that the Earth was the center of the universe and that we were special. And then we, with Copernicus and Galileo and others, that the Earth, the Sun was the center of the universe. And then we found in the 20th century that our whole solar system is moving around the center of the galaxy, and our galaxy is just one of billions of galaxies. And now we think there might even be billions and trillions and zillions of other universes. So what's the point? Well, I have wrestled with this, and it sounds like you have too. And of course, I don't know the answer to the question, but I think that I personally do not feel that there is any cosmic point. I don't think that there's any point or purpose that's given to us by a divinity. I think that each of us has to find our own point, our what we think is the purpose of our lives. And I think that could vary from one individual to the next, what they feel is the purpose of their life. We're all different, and I'm glad that we are, and each person finds their own meaning. But I do think it's important that we all try to live meaningful lives, and that means that we need to think about this sometimes and not just check off items on our to-do list.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We'll move on to David calling from Westbrook. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have two questions. First is, what happened after you had the experience in the boat? Did your spiritual practice actually change? Did it impact your life in a particular way in terms of a daily basis? And secondly, I'm going back to that experience in the boat again from a different angle, and I'm wondering if there's not a strict dichotomy between the physical universe and the I, and perhaps God, if you want to call it that, that perhaps in that moment in the boat, you were really listening to what was the universe was trying to tell you. Carl Jung paid very close attention to that moment, and he found the answer in synchronicity when he struggled with a question, when he found that things seemed to just line up as if they were almost paving the way, preparing the path so he could go to the answer, a particular answer. So Richard Tarnas, incidentally, speaks a lot about that in his book, Cosmos and Psyche.
All right, David, go ahead, Alan.
Well, first question, what happened after the experience in the boat? And I should say that I've had many experiences of that nature, which I call transcendent experiences, and I'm sure that you have and many of our listeners have as well. I think that I have, after those experiences, I just feel a greater connection to the rest of the cosmos. And I guess it also helps me think about my own death in a certain way. We're all going to die. But if we think of ourselves as part of a long chain of humanity going back thousands of years in the past and thousands of years in the future, then we're part of something that doesn't die. In terms of your second question about the distinction between the physical universe and what you might call a spiritual universe or a God universe, I do think that the physical universe and the spiritual universe both have their own domain of validity. I think that all issues dealing with material world lie within the realm of science, and statements about the material world, even if they're statements made in the sacred books or statements made by the religious institutions, they have to be judged by the methods of science and evaluated. But science is not all there is, and I do think that there is a spiritual universe that is not reducible by the methods of science, and the transcendent experience would be a part of that spiritual world.
David, thank you for your call. And we have another David, this David calling from Wells. Hi, David, go ahead.
Hi there, Jennifer and Dr. Lightman. I'm glad that you brought up the subject of death, doctor, because that's what I actually wanted to ask you about. A good friend of mine has written an amazing novel about the afterlife, about heaven, in which he postulates or asserts, in a purely fictional way, of course, that when we die, our spirits, our consciousnesses become dark matter. And in sort of inhabit the universe in the form of dark matter. So two quick questions I wanted to ask you. One, is there any scientific reason why that notion might be impossible? And then secondly, do you harbor any hopes in your own mind that your ego might somehow transcend human life?
Thank you, David. In answer to the first question, science believes that the body is purely material and purely atoms and molecules. And according to the view of science, when we die, the special arrangement of those atoms and molecules that make neurons, which then leads to the sensation that we call consciousness, that becomes undone, and there's no longer consciousness. But the atoms remain. If you could label every atom in your body with your social security number and follow them all, you could still find them 1,000 years from now. So some of those atoms will go out into the ocean, and some of them will go up into space, and some of them could coagulate around other atoms that we call dark matter. There wouldn't be any consciousness associated with those atoms. A few of them might have your social security number written on them, but your consciousness and memories would not be there. Should I go on to the second question?
Briefly.
Let's see. Remind me again the second question. What do I hope happens to my body? Well, I hope that after I die, that the atoms with my social security number will become parts of other lovely people.
That's a great answer. David in Wells, you'll be our last caller. And Alan Lightman, thank you so much for joining us today. This hour seemed awfully short. I think we were messing with time. Alan Lightman is a theoretical physicist, novelist, and educator, and part-time Maine resident. His earlier novel, Einstein's Dreams, was an international bestseller, and his newest book is called Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. Alan will be speaking about his book in Portland next month on May 30th at Print Bookstore. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.